Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by the Maine Historical Wargamers Association. They're the folks behind Huzzah! Historical Wargaming for New England. Huzzah will take place May 18th through the 20th, 2018, at the Doubletree in South Portland, Maine. Experience some of the best historical wargaming at Huzzah! Visit www.huzzahcon.com for more information. Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by Enfilade. Enfilade is a flagship historical wargaming convention for the Northwest Historical Miniature Gaming Society. Enfilade is held annually over Memorial Day weekend at the Red Lion Inn in Olympia, Washington. Enjoy the largest historical miniature gaming convention west of the Mississippi at Enfilade. Visit www.nhmgscitadel.com for more information. Welcome to Wargaming Recon. I am your host, Jonathan J. Reinhardt. Wargaming Recon is the only member of the TSR Podcast Network to discuss historical and New England gaming. This is episode... Add another episode number down. What episode number are you?
I don't know. Not my job.
I swear I had it down, but it's not there.
And I worked really hard to not laugh at the cheese intro and...
See, I downplayed it just for you because I was thinking about that.
Yeah, and you cocked it up anyway.
Let's roll this up. I think it's 2-2-2-0-something? 210. Okay, I should write that down.
Yeah, write that down.
Okay. Here we go. Number 210. Okay, much better.
Okay.
Once more with feeling, huh? Okay. Welcome to Wargaming Recon. I am your host, Jonathan J. Reinhardt. Wargaming Recon is the only member of the TSR Podcast Network to discuss historical and New England gaming. This is episode 210, Travel Battle Review. So welcome all of you new and longtime listeners alike. I think you're in for a treat with this episode. We've been talking about it for a while, saying that we will be reviewing the Perry Miniatures Travel Battle, and at last... we are. I'm not going to go into why we've been delayed. We've talked about that plenty of times on other episodes, but I do want to welcome my buddy and co-host, Mr. Adrian Benson. Adrian, how are you?
I'm doing great, John. Thank you.
So are you as excited as I am about reviewing Travel Battle?
Yes.
I thought you might be. We're actually going to probably dive a little deeper than we normally do into things with this episode. So people will want to be sure to check out our show notes. We'll have links to things like how you can get your hands on a copy of Travel Battle if you so choose, along with other things for it, the FAQ. And we're also going to be talking about a little bit of a review for some products from Things from the Basement. So we'll have links to those as well. And rather than burden you with them during the audio episode, you can just go to our show notes at WargamingRecon.com/WR210. That's WargamingRecon.com/WR210. And you can get all those links and all that kind of stuff there. So Adrian, you and I have been saying for, geez, I don't want to say how long it's been, but a long time, right? That we were going to review Travel Battle and we were all excited about it and all that kind of stuff.
And, we are.
Would you say that you're glad that we are finally doing it?
Yeah, definitely. We've had it. I don't even remember when they sent it to you, but we've had it for a while.
You raise a good point. Travel Battle came to us courtesy of the Perry brothers over at Perry Miniatures, rather, for us to review. And when it first came out, we had approached them and said, hey, we're kind of interested in what you're doing there. It seems different and new and not really like anything else that was on the market at the time. And they very kindly sent us a review copy for us to do. And we did some unboxing videos. You can find those on our YouTube channel or wherever you get our videos. Why don't you give a little bit of an overview about Travel Battle for our listeners?
Basically, it's a take it with you wherever you go kind of beer and pretzels Napoleonic warfare game, miniatures game. It ships with two completely equal sides. Their figures are, I'm not sure what scale they are. They're not 10. They're smaller than 10, bigger than 6.
8 mil, I believe.
Is it? Okay, so... you get two completely equal armies, one in red, one in blue, and you have two plastic map board sections with terrain molded onto the map board, so the map boards are the same, every time, except that you can rearrange them in numerous different positions. So the battlefield is it's not always exactly the same, but obviously with the pre-molded terrain, you're a little bit limited, but that's fine for what it is. It gives you enough variety that you don't feel like you're fighting the same battle over and over again. The rules are really simple. It's, 10, maybe 12 pages. And some of that is guides to actually painting the miniatures and the maps, which if you look online and just search on Travel Battle, you'll see that a lot of people are painting the boards and the figures and really doing a great job with it, better than I do with most of my stuff, actually. And that's great. I mean, if you want to do that, for me, that kind of defeats the purpose of it as being a take it with you anywhere, quick play game. But people are doing some really nice work with the figures and the maps.
I agree with you. I think the fact that this is a completely different scale kind of threw people off. They were like, wait a sec. We don't normally play Napoleonics, in that scale. We don't play Ancients really in that scale. 8 mil is, when you get into that small, you're talking usually 10 mil or 6 mil maybe.
Yeah.
But like 8 mil was just really odd. And word on the street was at the time that the Perrys were going to release their whole line of 8 mil figures, which has since been untrue as of us recording this in the early, late spring, early summer of 2018. But I agree. Like, I think part of the purpose of the fact that they have a red army and a blue army is so you don't have to paint them. And I mean, people have done gorgeous work here.
Oh, yeah.
The stuff is just amazing. But why would you?
Well, if it makes you happy, you should go ahead and do it. But I would never paint it because, like I said, that kind of defeats the purpose of the game to me.
I think it's really neat because not only is it a great set of rules that you could bring with you, because not many games are this portable in a self-contained unit. This really is. The history behind it is quite impressive. So people might not know, but one of the Perry brothers had managed to injure himself reenacting and was in the hospital for a while. And on his road to recovery, while being in the hospital for a very long time, wanted to continue to wargame. And his brother was great and brought in some figures. And you can actually see, if you watch our video, you'll be able to see a view of the board that they had. And they were using, 6 millimeter Heroics and Ross Company figures to do it. And that was the impetus of this, so that they brought this and they could play it in the hospital. And in playing it time and time again, they realized they kind of had some rules there that they could use and that maybe other people might be interested. And more people kind of found out about it and spread the word and said, hey, that's an interesting idea. And lo and behold, many, many years later, they come out with Travel Battle. And I think the name is probably not what they used originally. I would presume that they picked it because it's very descriptive. It's a battle that you travel with.
Yeah, well, it totally describes the intention, yeah.
You know, like, that's a great thing in the name. Picking a name is hard, right? And picking one that's really ideal for your product or your entity, your company, your business, it's hard. So when you have a good brand, Perry Miniatures, it tells you all about them, right? Their miniature company, it's a Perry, so you have that name recognition. You have the subject of what they're doing. And then Travel Battle, although it doesn't specifically tell you that it's Napoleonics or the scale or any of that kind of stuff, it gives you a hint because it lets you know this is something that I can travel with. I think we've all seen pictures or talked with friends who've, say, gone to tourneys, right? And they bring in, like, their big bolt action army or Warhammer 40K army or whatever, and they go into a destination and they're trying to pack it in the car or on the plane or get it going, and it's hard to bring it with you. This is something that you could bring with you to a convention. You can bring with you when you go on a family vacation or you're on a business trip, and you can pull it out and you can play it in your hotel room. You can play it at poolside. You can play it at the beach. You can play it almost anywhere because it doesn't take up a lot of space. And yet it has a lot of action packed into the physical space that you get.
Yeah.
You kind of highlighted a little bit about its overall view in play, but why don't we work our way through what a turn tends to be. Actually, why don't we back up and say what the objective of the game is, right? Because it's a fully fledged game. I think of it as a fusion between a board game and a miniatures game, which is really the trend that's going on now between miniatures games going down to skirmish level because people don't have time for these large games. But then also people are really getting into that hybrid model of, is it a board game? Is it a miniatures war game? Is it both? And they're doing that here with us. But what would you say the objective is? Like, you're the red...
Kill the other guy. Well, that's the objective. So you get your troops at the beginning, and there's, what, 8 infantry regiments or whatever you want to call it, 4 cavalry, some artillery. And you got to divide these troops up basically however you want into 3 different brigades. So you have to have 3 different command entities. And the objective of the game is to destroy 2 of the other players' brigades. Whoever does that first wins.
Yeah. And you literally just destroy stands of units, whether it's cavalry, it's artillery, or it's infantry. And the brigadier general who's attached to that brigade doesn't really count. It's a unit, we think, right? We'll get to that a little bit later. But it doesn't count as being destroyed. You can't kill the general. So it's kind of like in any of those other games. Like if you play Black Powder, right, Adrian? You don't kill the general. He just kind of steps out of the way. Unlike, say, older editions of Warhammer 40K or Warhammer Fantasy, for example, where you can actually, like Fantasy, you could challenge the enemy general and you have one-on-one combat and they do the whole thing and they get stat lines and stuff. That doesn't happen in Travel Battle. That doesn't happen in like Black Powder, for example.
Doesn't happen in a lot of war games like that. Yeah, you can't. I mean, there are ways to have your general killed in Black Powder and in other, you know, tabletop miniature games, but generally speaking, you can't specifically target the general. So this is no different than that.
Yeah, it definitely follows that trend. And the board is an interesting setup for a board, right? I think they tried as hard as they could to make it fair, and I don't want to say equal. I think people often confuse equal and fairness when it comes to war games, because equal, like they want, you know, I have a 2-inch square block in this corner. You need to have a 2-inch square block in that corner, corresponding corner for it to be. And that doesn't have to be it. It has to have, I think, a fair distribution of the terrain types and the features and all that kind of stuff. So these boards, they have a mix of roads, right, which give you a movement bonus. We'll come to that in a moment. Buildings, which they count as built-up areas. Wooded areas, which are, have their own terrain features. And then hills of corresponding heights. But there is one board I actually think is a better board to get if you happen to get it, and let me see if I can pull that out. It's the one that has a higher hill on it, and that might just be a psychological benefit that I'm thinking of as opposed to a real in-game benefit. But there's one board, and again on the video, we normally try not to make things rely so much on the video, but there's actually a lot of things that you need to see with this. But there's a level 2 hill, so you go up one, that's level 1, right? And the next one's level 2. So that actually allows you to basically get commanding presence with your artillery, because you can see over almost anything, right, Adrian? To shoot at almost anything. And then it also has a wooded area, which can kind of give you a nice defensive position. It would be harder for enemy troops to kind of come in and go up. And depending on how your opponent places the board or how you connect it with the other one, because all of them are modular, right? So each side links up appropriately. You could actually have more of a commanding presence here. And then it also has a nice on the an opposite area, nice area built up with 3 houses, so kind of a town if you think about it. No, the other board doesn't have that, and nowhere else on any of the boards do you have that built up of an area. It's mostly open. So I don't know about you, but what do you think? Would you say this is probably a better board?
Not necessarily, because it depends on how the boards are laid out, which is randomized in the setup. So it might be, but. True. It that level 2 hill, depending on how the boards are laid out, could end up being not worth very much. I mean, the way sighting works in the game, the level 2 hill is of questionable value anyway. I mean, it's valuable, but I don't think it's any more valuable than a level 1 hill.
No, it's not a game breaker or anything like that. But I think by having that extra height, it could play a more decisive role. But having a hill, period, actually, I think is more valuable than not having a hill for you to place your artillery on. And depending on how the board's arrayed, which isn't completely up to you, the player, because you do roll a dice for that, you don't necessarily have a whole lot of say in how it goes, which is kind of nice because you can't, you know, jury rig it into your favor, right? Which I think is a nice thing. When you set up the game, why don't we just kind of work through how this goes? And I know you and I have questions about things and areas that we think aren't completely clear, but we should come back to those. We'll have a special section of the show where we're going to tackle things that don't make sense to us, or questions or areas of improvement and things of that sort of stuff. So that way you guys don't have to have tidbits here and there and be like, oh, well, they said here that. So after you get your army, right, as you said, you create your three brigades. What's the next step that you got to take as a player?
Well, then you decide, you roll die, decide who is going to set up first.
Yep.
And so it's a die roll, and it doesn't say specifically, but we went whoever rolls the high dice, they set up their brigade first, one of their brigades first, and then you just alternate until everyone is done.
And I like that randomized placement in that the whole alternating setup really kind of introduces a little bit of a strategic element there. So if you, I'm someone like when I play chess, right, I like to play as the black side because I like the other side to get everything out. And then I like to get the first move. But some people, or rather I like the second move, but some people like to do it the other way because they want to get things started. But in this, I really like to play so that I can see, like, for example, where you're going to set yourself up. And in a game we played this week, I think that influenced things a little bit because you had to set up one brigade first, and you set it up in the far left corner of the board, again on a hill. You had a nice emplacement. But as things were, I was able to basically keep all my troops away from you and cause you to have to bring your brigade all the way across the battlefield toward me, basically keeping them out of the game for many turns, right?
Yeah, yeah, until the very end game.
And so you can kind of have that. Usually, though, I would say a player is going to be like, okay, there's a brigade directly in front of me, so I'm going to place my brigade right here. So you have a correspondent. You don't have any gaps. I just happen to play, what would you say, unorthodox?
For you, yeah, yeah.
In that kind of setup. So after you have your brigades all out, and this is after, of course, after you did your die rolls to choose what side of the board that you're going to play, because each board has numbers that kind of hard because they're molded in the plastic. There's a three, there's a one or two. If you roll a five or six, you get to choose what side you do. And then the other player places the board next to it. And then it's a you go setup, right? For each turn.
Yeah.
Yep. And there's a series of phases that you kind of work through so that like I move all my units.
Yeah. You move everybody. And we should probably talk about the movement. Infantry units and artillery units move one, always. Well, not always.
Mostly.
Cavalry units move two.
Mostly.
Generals move two.
Mostly.
However, if you start and end your move on a road, then you get an extra movement. So infantry could move two, cavalry and generals could move three. Terrain will affect your movement. Actually, terrain doesn't really affect your movement, but there's some terrain. Woods, for example, only infantry can go into a woods, which, as we'll talk about later, brought about one of our big questions about the game. Actually, I think that's the only movement restriction, right? Infantry can't go in the woods, and that's it. Or is the only one that can go in the woods, and that's it.
Well, it's more of a placement, but I'm going to say it's kind of a movement restriction. Infantry are also the only unit in the game that you can double up. So if you have right. infantry, right, and they're in an open board square, think of them being just like out in a field somewhere. You can, and I'm trying to give a visual aid, but you basically can rank them up so that you have one in front and one in back. And a good thing about this comes into play when you're attacking, because each unit, when you attack, they would be adjacent to an enemy. And we'll get into attacking in a moment. So they each get to roll a die to do an attack. The bad thing is if they're under artillery fire, and that square gets hit, and that square gets damaged, each unit actually gets a negative modifier, I believe, for artillery attack. And then infantry, if they're going into a woods or built-up area, you can only have one stand in that square. So you'd have to move one out as such. Facing doesn't matter in the game. So you get 360-degree arc, basically, for everyone. Actually, yeah. Whatever. You can move diagonal. That doesn't count as extra movement. So to go in kitty corner, that's from one spot to the next, it's still one move. So you can actually get some ingenious movement. And then if they don't refer to it this way, but when you and I played recently, this is how I kept referring to it. But your command radius is such that you have to have every unit, including your general. And I'm going to put an asterisk on calling a general a unit, but we'll come back to that too. But every unit, every base has to be touching in that brigade. Otherwise, they can't move, but they could still they can still fight. They can still shoot.
Yeah, they can be chained. They don't. Not everybody has to be touching everybody. So, I mean, listeners probably understand that, but you can chain them. But basically,
yeah,
every unit of your brigade has to be in contact with another unit, which is in contact with the general. In order to do anything with the units in your brigade, they have to be in contact with the general. So if there's any break in that chain, you can't give orders to units to move. There are some exceptions to that. Artillery can still shoot. And if you get attacked, you can obviously defend yourself. You can fight back, but you're unable to move unless you're in contact with the brigade leader.
Or unless it's not a voluntary movement, if it's a combat result.
Oh, yeah.
If you and then movement, but it's a combat result that happens. Why don't we talk about artillery for a moment? I don't know about you, but I'm underwhelmed by artillery, which is a shame because I love artillery.
Actually, I think artillery is pretty good. I mean, it can shoot out to a range of six. And it's very simple to resolve. If you're shooting at a target six squares away, you need to roll six to hit it. If the target is five squares away, you need a five to hit it, or a six. And if it's four away, then you need a four or better to hit it. And I think you can see the progression. And after a hit, you just roll die to see the result. And you have, I think, a 1 in 6 chance of killing the unit outright, or you can force it to retreat and take a morale check.
Yep.
So I actually don't have a problem with artillery. Artillery is pretty powerful. It's probably why you only get two artillery pieces in the game instead of three.
To start anyway, and that's something we should touch on a little bit later, there, you do get a -1 when you're targeting a unit that's in the woods or a built-up area, like a house or whatever. That's fine. That just makes sense. And there are certain situations with artillery, because it's shooting, right? This is really the only shooting in the game. But there's certain situations with special rules, I'm going to say, I think the way I explained it to you, right, Adrian, was I have to think of it now as a checklist to see which criteria are met.
Yeah, we had some questions about how line of sight is supposed to work. I'll let you cover it. But I think we did it wrong the first couple of times we played, and then this last couple of times we had it figured out. But you can go ahead and explain what the deal was.
I think I've played this either with you or with Alex or other people. I think I played it maybe half a dozen, almost double digits number of times, and I feel like every single time have gotten something wrong. And part of it is because it's a game that's been played so infrequently.
Yeah.
And played with different people, so that each time it's kind of like playing it for the first time and having to look back and things, because we're doing other stuff too. So trying to keep up with that is not always the easiest thing, but that's one thing that kind of makes it tricky. And shooting is one area where we have that. But we'll cover our shooting things in, I don't know what you want to call it, but our problem bucket, I guess, where we throw everything but the kitchen sink up there. So if you're not shooting, the next thing that you do, you start with movement, go to shooting, and then you do combat, close combat, you're doing fighting if you have units touching, right?
Right.
And so you have an attacker, you have a defender, everyone who's touching, that sounds really weird. Every unit that's adjacent to an enemy unit engages in combat, and you roll dice, and depending on the unit, you might roll more dice, you get modifiers. No, you don't get any modifiers, do you? You roll more dice, or you might get a reroll, rather, and wins, right?
Basically. Certain units get a reroll. They have heavy cavalry and guard units that can reroll their dice if they want to.
Guard have a flag on them.
Yeah, it's just matching dice rolls, and the high die wins. And depending on how much you win by, it depends on the result to the defender. They may just fall back one square and turn around, which means basically they can't move next turn. They might have to retreat all the way to the board edge and turn around, meaning they can't move next turn. But they also then have to take a morale check, which if they fail, they run away. Or they may be destroyed outright.
Yeah, the magic number you're looking for is you want to win by at least three if you're hoping to destroy your enemy. I don't know about you, but I actually think that the ideal result isn't to destroy the enemy, although that's the purpose, but it's to force them to the board edge.
Why is that?
Well, you push them out of action for potentially many, many turns. And depending on how things go with what we experienced last game, you could potentially actually be forcing them off the board and therefore destroying them that way if you don't bring them up. If you have further combat in that column, if you think of the board almost like a spreadsheet with your rows of columns, and if units keep on getting pushed back, potentially. you could have that going on too. But I think for me, the main bonus is they're out of the fight. So unless the Brigadier goes back and rescues them, they got to just stay where they are. And so if it's infantry or cavalry, that's many turns with which you can get better position. You can take out other units and maybe other brigades. So you can have like one really strong brigade. You could just kind of keep on pushing them back and put them out of the fight for a while.
Yeah, I kind of disagree with that. I mean, considering that the purpose of the, or the point of the game is to kill the other guy, then the ideal result is, you know, killing the other guy. So,
well, eventually, I think it depends where in the game you're at, because there's no turn limit, which is an important thing to raise. Play basically for as long as you want to play, right?
Yeah, you do. I don't think we've ever had a game go over an hour, but yeah.
I've had some short games, some games that have ended in maybe 20 minutes at most.
Yeah.
And some that have gone, like you said, about an hour. I think an hour for this kind of game is a little long. I think the first few times you play it, an hour's fine. But I think this game really should have a running time of between 30 and 45 minutes.
Yeah, if you're just playing it, yeah. We do a lot of talking in addition to playing, but yeah.
So like shooting, there's also kind of a checklist for other special things that happen. Basically, re-rolling dice and all that goes. You talked about rally, and there's only one special formation, I guess is the way to refer to it, that you can have in the game, and that's forming square. And I like the simplicity of how they do forming square when you have a unit that's comprised of two rows of figures on a base.
Yeah.
You go diagonal, and so that gives you a bonus against cavalry, but then you have to like come out of it, which counts as your movement, so you can do other stuff. And actually, if you're in square, I believe you're more susceptible to artillery fire and things of that sort. And those are the rules in a nutshell. Of course, there's more details for the game for specifics.
There are, but not much, to be honest with you.
Why don't we talk about some of the things that we liked about it before we dive into our problem bucket?
Okay, you first.
I love the fact that the MSRP, I think, is very reasonable. It's 50 British pounds. I'm not going to give it to you in American dollars because that changes all the time, right? Although right now, the dollar is doing great against the pound because of Brexit and so forth. And it's probably a great time to buy.
Yeah, good time to pick it up.
Downside. Yeah. Oh, you give the except.
You got to pay that Royal Mail shipping, and that ain't it ain't cheap.
That's true, because to my knowledge anyway, and I don't know about you, Adrian, but as far as I know, there are no American distributors for it. I don't know of any game stores that carry it. I don't know of any like online vendors. I know people go to like, say, Miniature Market or Amazon or the War Store, for example. None of them seem to have it, to my knowledge. And it's been out for a while.
Yeah, it has been. No, I don't know of any that do have it. I mean, we could easily be wrong about that. I don't know if anybody knows. Feel free to speak up. But I don't think anyone in the U.S. I don't think any of their U.S. distributors have it. Could be wrong. But yeah, no, it is for the money they went for it, it's a good value, I think. But like I say, if you have to add in that, just to put it in, I just ordered a few things direct from Foreground. I had to order it direct from them because nobody that I normally go to that I could tell had it. And the shipping was unbelievable. It was as much for the shipping as it was for the price of the stuff that I bought. So.
Yeah, that's crazy. And that's just going across the pound. Imagine if you were like in not Australia, because they get bent over for everything. But imagine like you were, I don't know, anywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
Not in the UK or Western Europe. You're going to pay an arm and a leg for that shipping. And it's nuts. And I mean, the thing comes in a nice box, comes in a handle. So it's not like it's huge, but it's large enough that it's going to be an awkward size. And it's not heavy. But again, it's heavy enough, right, for the shipment?
Yeah, it's kind of heavy. I mean, the maps are pretty solid plastic and everything. They're not flimsy at all. So it's got a little weight to it. I mean, it is what it is. If you want to buy it, then unless we're completely wrong, which we so frequently are, and there's a U.S. distributor for it, if you want it, you'll just have to eat the shipping costs. But I mean, that's not that big of a deal, really, if you want the thing.
No, but if any of you know of anywhere in the States or North America to get it, please let us know, because we'd love to be wrong about this and to update it with that. Yeah. Another thing I like about it, and people laugh at me all the time, but I love an excuse to not paint. And you got your blue army, you got your red army. It's very old school that way. Yes, you could paint them, but you don't need to paint them So you can get it out of the box, get going. It's easy to assemble. I did a whole video on that where you basically just cut everything from the sprue with side cutters and use some super glue and let it sit for a moment or two and you're done. The build-ins come in halves. So you cut each half and then you match them up and you glue and you're done. I let mine sit overnight. You glue all the stuff to the base and you're done. Because I was doing a recording, I spent a lot longer doing that than you really need to.
Yeah.
But there's no assembly for the base, for the terrain boards. There's no assembly for the woods. The woods are tops that you cut off and they just sit on there. And you don't want to glue them on because you need to put your guys in there if you move into it. So that's something you're not going to glue. And I'm going to say you don't want to glue the hoses to the boards either.
Probably not, because then when you store the boards in the box, I would think rubbing around together, there might be a potential that you could break them off the peg. I don't think I'd glue them to the board.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. They all have a little peg in them, so you can just kind of slide it into the slot and then they stay there. I suppose if you're painting your board, then you could paint it all and then glue them and just use like really good strong glue, some sort of epoxy or something, you know, that chemically bonds so that they become one solid piece, basically. But otherwise, I wouldn't glue them. So you're talking like the whole assembly. There is assembly, but it's pretty easy. I think it's pretty straightforward that almost anyone can do it, whether you're new or a longtime grognard, you can kind of get into it. I think the rules are short enough that you can read them in a lunch hour and get pretty good handle on them. And I think that it's an appealing period, right? People love Napoleonics, but a big reason why a lot of people don't play, even if they have a lot of stuff, is you need the space, you need the time to play like an 8 or 12 hour game, and you need all the stuff. It's a lot of time, a lot of money, all that kind of stuff. So you get, I think, flavor of the period with minimal expense, minimal time, and minimal space issues. I think the concept is brilliant. I really don't think there's anyone else who's done this as well as they have. When you're talking about packaging, when you're talking about the artwork, the box, the general concept, and that higher level view of it, I think it does all that very, very well. What are some things that you like?
Now, you hit a lot of the high points for me too. I like the self-contained nature of it best. I mean, you just throw everything in a little like briefcase box and you're good to go. Components are all high quality. Even the miniatures are really, I won't call them detailed, but they're fairly nicely sculpted if you look at them close, which is the kind of thing you'd expect from the Perrys. The quality of everything in the box is really good. Like I say, for the price, I do think you're getting your money's worth for it. The rules are simple. You said you could read them in a lunch hour. You could probably read them in a lunch 15 minutes, actually. It's not complicated. It is a popular period, and it gives an okay feel for the period. With a simple game like that, there's only so much you can do. But they have the guards in there. They've got the heavy cavalry, which gives it just a little bit of flavor. And we'll probably talk about it later, but there's some additional things that you can do that will give it even more of that Napoleonic feel to it. It's reasonably fun to play. I mean, we had a good time with it. And it's fast. That's the big thing. It's self-contained and it's fast. I mean, obviously, there's plenty of games out there, board games and whatnot, that you can pack around too. Not a lot of them are as quick and convenient to set up and play as fast. And this kind of has it covered. I mean, this would be kind of the perfect thing. Like, just for example, we were just at Huzzah, and it's kind of a good convention, good thing to bring along to the convention, because you know, you finish one game, you've got an hour, maybe an hour and 15 minutes until your next game. What are you going to do to fill the time, go back to the room or whatever? But you could sit down and play that way, wait for your next game to start. So, those are my favorite things about it, actually. It's easy. It's easy to pack along. It's reasonably fun, and you can play it fast.
I should add that they've actually come out with, on their website, and we'll have a link in the show notes, but they have an FAQ that answers some of the most commonly asked questions, as you would guess. But on top of it, they've added two sections of new rules.
Yeah.
They don't supplant what's in the book, but they kind of add to it. So you can add horse artillery by using the same models, but basically allows artillery to attach to a cavalry brigade. It changes their movement so they can actually move more quickly, reduces their distance for what they can hit. And then there's also the addition of skirmishers, which I guess one of the Perry Miniatures customers, a guy named Christian, had suggested as a tweak. And it just kind of adds a little bit more flavor to round out things instead of just having, you know, line infantry and heavy and like cavalry and that kind of stuff going on. So it kind of allows you to do a little bit more. With the skirmishers, though, I think the way that they have to be based, you wouldn't have a double row of infantry on a base. So I think you do actually have to buy more models to do that.
Yeah.
If you want to use the skirmishers. But if you just wanted to, you know, be like, this counts as, I think that's in the whole kind of, idea of the game that you're able to be a little more laid back with things.
Yeah. Which, I'll say this about buying the extra figures. When you looked at them on the website, unless I'm wrong, they were in gray plastic.
They are.
So you will have to paint those. I mean, you can just get yourself a can of blue and red spray paint and do it that way, but just word to the wise.
Yeah, and actually that's a good point, because that's a new thing that they've added since it first came out. You can buy each of the battle boards. They retail for £14 a piece. You can buy additional sprues of the miniatures, which retail for £3 a piece. And those sprues come with 40 infantry. They come with 3 heavy cavalry, 3 light cavalry, 1 artillery piece, plus crew, and then 2 mounted officers. And if you're thinking about it, basically 3 cavalry form 1 base, and 6, no, I'm not, that's not right. What is it? 10? Yeah, 10 infantry form 1 base. So that gives you an idea. You basically get 4 bases of infantry plus 1 base each of heavy. No, that's not right. There's
2 cavalry on a base.
2 cavalry. No, it is 3.
Is it?
It is 3. Mm. And then basically 1 base of heavy, 1 base of light cavalry, plus 1 artillery piece. So if you want to scale it up, you kind of get an idea of what you need. They are 8mm plastic, they're gray. And then you can also get, probably because you might, if you buy more miniatures and you buy more other stuff, you can buy a sprue of bases, and that's enough bases for 4 sprues worth of miniatures. That's 4 British pounds. You can buy more houses to go on your battle boards. And if you get any battle boards, each battle board comes with all the sprues you need for all the trees on both of them. And then, like I said, you get the game itself, the box game for £50, whatever that ends up translating into and converting into for your currency. So that's just kind of neat that they've added those extra rules and that kind of stuff. I think it shows that they didn't just launch and give up on it, that they have invested a little bit more into it.
Yeah.
Why don't we kind of dive into combination of our problems and our questions? Because we had a lot of things that we just weren't sure about, right?
Yeah, and it's possibly we just don't know what we're doing. But there were a couple of issues with. See, one of the things with a short rule book like that is that it's easy to read, it's quick, and you can start playing fast. The thing that's bad about a short rule book like that is it can leave a lot of ambiguity because things aren't fully explained. So one of the issues we had, and I don't know if you can put the put one of the boards up there to sort of illustrate it, was with, so if you engage and have a combat result, and what we had was an artillery piece in front of a woods that had to fall back, meaning that we'll have to, that was very professional. That,
yes, it was very professional. Josh, I'm sure Josh was like, John, what are you doing? Just stop ruining it. This is why we can't have nice things. Clang, oh, clang, clang.
So anyway, the artillery piece had to fall back into the woods one square and turn around and so forth. The problem is that artillery can't move through the woods. Only infantry can move through the woods. We talked about that earlier. So in a case like that, what do you do? Is the artillery piece destroyed because it can't retreat? Because that's a thing in a lot of games. If you're forced to retreat but can't, the unit's destroyed. Or do you fall back through the woods, or what do you do with it? I think the best way to handle that would be the artillery can't move into the woods, but it has to move into the woods, but it can't, therefore it's destroyed. I think the way we played it, though, was that the artillery fell back into the woods and then through the woods. And it was even more complicated than that, now that I think of it, because it was actually an infantry unit in that square.
Yeah.
So the rules say that if you fall back into another unit, then that unit gets pushed back. So that makes perfect sense. That still leaves the artillery piece in the woods. Well, he can't be in the woods, so he has to fall back another square. But then that infantry piece was behind him again. So does that get pushed back again? That's the way we played it. So basically what we had was this artillery piece fell back actually like 2 squares and pushed the infantry unit that was behind him back 2 squares. I don't think that's necessarily right, but you can't know if it's right or wrong because the rules don't say. I think the right thing to do actually would have been just to have the artillery piece be destroyed. But that was one issue that we kind of had in the rules. And did we look at the fact while we were at the store playing? I think we did.
Yeah, I did a search on it because I had my computer, so I could just I searched for artillery to see if artillery was mentioned at all about that. And I did not see it, to be honest. I could have missed it, but I didn't see it. Most artillery things are about the horse artillery.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I didn't think we could find anything. So that was a question we had that came up. Another one had to do, and we worked this out. We were doing it wrong before, but that was the line of sight with the artillery. I don't know if you want to talk about that or if you just want to. I mean, we figured out we were probably doing it wrong, so I actually don't really consider it a problem anymore.
Well, I think most of the things here are probably going to be a case of either the game designers or anyone really just saying, well, whoever's playing, just, you know, work it out amongst yourselves. And that's fine, usually, except, as you said, and this is a problem I have, and I'm not normally so harsh about things, but when you have a set of rules that are so short, they need to be very clearly written. And I don't think that they need to have a lot of depth. I don't think you need to have paragraph after paragraph and tons of illustrations showing every possible outcome. I really don't think that needs to be there. But if you're describing something, you need to make sure that you remove all potential doubt. And I know that writing rules is very hard because someone, usually me, will interpret them differently than you ever intended, and maybe differently than they're supposed to be. And this is definitely not a case of, like, it's a tournament game, so it matters for that kind of thing, whatever. It's definitely more laid back. But at the same point, like, let's pretend you're using this to teach someone who's not used to this style of gaming, whether it's a younger person, whether it's whatever. You want to make sure that it's done consistently so that if they play with anyone else, they're having that consistent experience, and so are other people. And that if there's any aberrations, it's clearly known that that is a house rule, right? Yeah. So, like, if you play Black Powder and there are certain rules about, I don't know, things like morale or whatever, that everyone's playing that the correct way, unless they say it's a house rule, because it's been clearly defined. And so, like, they don't clearly define what to do with the case of that artillery, as you said. And it wouldn't be a problem, except they do define what's supposed to happen when you get a combat result like that. When it's a case of it's getting pushed back, but it's not like, it doesn't have like an excerpt that says, well, if it can't, then this. Or it doesn't even say anywhere in the rules that I can see. In case of discrepancy, just work it out amongst yourself. And maybe they figure people are just going to be gentlemanly enough that they're going to do that. But again,
yeah, I mean, that should be obvious. But
you need that unified experience. You need to have that so that it's fair, again, wherever someone's playing. So that, like, if you and I are playing, we interpret it one way. But then if you go play with Alex, you go play at a convention and bring it, that everyone else is interpreting it the same way.
Yeah.
And so, like, I think that's an issue. The point about artillery and line of sight comes back to what I have to think of as the checklist for what you need to do. So there's multiple things. It's not bulleted, but it's basically a bullet point list where you have to look to see what criteria applies. And what we had done a few times, and me definitely more than you, was kind of looking at things as we were playing and be like, well, part of one line says this and part of another says that, and kind of extrapolating one and interpreting the rules between the two to be like, well, maybe this other rule therefore kind of applies to this other thing, which wasn't the case. So the example is, like, if you have an artillery piece on a hill, right, a level one hill, and it's shooting at an infantry unit that's behind a level one hill, literally the square right after it, can that artillery piece see and shoot at that infantry unit? And you and I have since come to an agreement that it can't.
Yeah.
But we weren't sure because the rules, if you looked at, and again, we were looking at that point just kind of while we were playing. So we were doing quick glances. We weren't really spending any time with the rules, which we have done since. And one part they say, like, if you want to target something, it says, quote, artillery needs to be able to see half or more of a target, i.e. without hills, buildings, or any intervening units in the way to be able to fire. But then later on, it also says, quote, artillery can fire overhead of any intervening unit if either gun or target are on a hill, unless there's a higher hill in the way, unquote. So a person could, as we did, and I'm going to say again erroneously, but a person could be like, oh, well, I have my artillery on a higher hill shooting at a unit that's on a lower hill, and there's no intervening unit, but they also say that intervening units block line of sight, just like a hill or target, a hill or building. Therefore, a hill or building doesn't block it if we're on different height levels.
Yeah, it specifically says if there's a higher hill in between, which there was not. There was just a hill in between.
Yes. But
like you said, if you look at it as a checklist, the very first thing that you check makes that shot not legal. So
yeah, so like you're literally looking and you're like, okay, I got my target. I am on a hill, which doesn't really matter. You need to literally look and say, okay, is there a target? Is there a unit between us that blocks line of sight? Nope. Okay. Is there anything else that blocks line of sight? Why? Yes, there is. There's a building, or in this case, there was a hill. So therefore, you don't even have to check for the other stuff.
Yeah.
It's because it's a hill and not a unit, not any infantry or cavalry or whatever. It doesn't matter about the height difference, because that specifically listed here is only for those units. So you're right, that's not an issue. But at the time, this kind of goes into not clearly written rules, which for me is a major bugbear. That just kind of causes some issues where I think it could trip people up as it tripped us up. And I mean, you and I have been playing war games, you longer than not me, but we've been playing in a long time.
Yeah, we're not new, and it did trip us up at first. I mean, we figured it out, and it's not unusual to like have to play a couple of games before you know all the ins and outs of it. So I'm kind of okay with that now that we figured it out. The first couple times we played though, and we were allowing those shots, I was like, I was actually getting a little. I was like, this doesn't make sense.
No,
and
it doesn't.
And indeed, it doesn't make sense. We were doing it wrong. So,
but I think people have to excuse us for interpreting it that way because of another thing that you and I agree doesn't make sense. And still, when I look at the rules, as far as I can see, but I could be missing it, as far as I can see, it works the way we were playing it, and that is cavalry attacking infantry in a built-up area.
Yeah.
Do you want to cover this one?
Well, it's just cavalry gets a bonus. They get an extra die if they're fighting just infantry. Mm-hmm. I think it's just infantry, not in a square, right?
Yes, that's correct.
If cavalry's attacking infantry in a town, they shouldn't get their cavalry bonus.
And then the infantry get...
It's really just as simple as that.
But then on top of it, right, the infantry get an extra dice for defending because they're in a built-up area. So you're getting even number of dice, and then you would get rerolls if you either have guard infantry or you have heavy cavalry. But either way, it's two dice to two dice, and you're picking the highest number out of all those dice for each side.
Yeah, and I'm fine with the heavy cavalry keeping their bonus. I'm fine with the guard infantry keeping their bonus. I'm fine with the infantry getting a bonus for defending a build-up area. They should.
Yes.
Cavalry should definitely not get their bonus attacking infantry in a build-up area. And we were talking about house rules. That's something you could house. Excuse me.
Yeah, and do you know, I think we would. But I tell you, like, I'm looking now, and I'm looking in combat, I'm looking in movement, and I swear to God, I can't find anything that says they don't get cavalry doesn't get the bonus in that case. And I could be wrong. It could be in here, but you and I both looked a lot, right?
Yeah. Well, there's not a lot of looking you can do. It's only 10 pages, but yeah, I didn't see anything in there that said that cavalry get the bonus against infantry unless they're attacking in the buildup area.
The exact wording here is, quote, cavalry fighting only infantry, not in a square formation, roll an additional dice. You can't be in a square formation.
Yeah, you got to be
in a built-up area, right? So yeah. Therefore,
they get their and they shouldn't. They shouldn't.
It's illogical to me, and I don't know if that just slipped through the crack. But again, this was something I thought, well, maybe this will be in the FAQ, and I didn't see it in there. And I don't know about you,
which surprised me because I would think that's there's two possible reasons for it. One, people don't care, and we're thinking about it too much. Or two, it came up in their game and they just either they don't care or they house ruled it away and said, oh yeah, no, cavalry didn't get a bonus attacking into a town.
And I think that's a fair thing to do. I think that would be a house rule. But it's unclear rules.
Well, to be fair, I mean, there's only a couple of points that were really unclear. There was the cavalry thing. And the cavalry thing isn't unclear. It's perfectly clear. Cavalry gets their bonus. They just shouldn't.
Well, I would agree. And do you know what? I bet if you asked the Perrys, they'd be like, well, yeah, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Like they shouldn't get that. We had a lot of questions, really. And some of them, I'm going to admit, are nitpicky, which probably means they're my questions, right? Because I tend to kind of hone in on that kind of stuff. But I'm going to blame that on my background as being an editor and having to edit journalism articles and all that kind of stuff. So like, I look for things that stand out that don't seem like they belong. So like a small one, which you already highlighted, was that it doesn't specifically say if you're looking for like a high roll for certain things. For the case of like at the beginning of the game, and I mean, one part it does say you want the highest roll, and that's for who moves all their forces first. But it doesn't say that you want a high roll for placing, you know, your brigades, who places first. I'm going to presume it's a high roll because it says it for the other thing, and because usually that's what you want, right? But it doesn't specifically say that.
No.
It doesn't say that either for, you know, picking, like a board. It just says, pick boards. Well, how? And it doesn't matter. I mean, you do it, but, like, you should clarify.
Yeah. Yeah, if the Perrys are watching, I just want to clarify that these are, in fact, Jonathan's complaints, not mine, because they are very nitpicky.
What other things did you have? I think you had something about line of sight with brigadiers.
Oh yeah, we weren't quite sure if a brigadier counted as a unit and therefore would block line of sight for artillery, and we ended up playing that he does block line of sight. Don't know if that's right or wrong. That should probably be spelled out. Typically, I shouldn't say typically, but oftentimes, like officers and stuff on the table don't block line of sight. It's almost like they're not there. But again, that wasn't spelled out in the rules, and it is identified as a unit. So we decided that, yeah, the general does, in fact, block line of sight, which is kind of a bummer because he blocks line of sight, but you can't shoot at him. So
that is a bummer.
Yeah.
And I know, like, I agree with you. A lot of rules specifically say, like, you can't target a general that they don't block line of sight. Like, I'm thinking of things like, say, black powder, which would be a set of rules the Perry brothers are familiar with because they're models were used in the books, and I know they've played it. But like, if you look at the rules under the assembly, there's a thing, it lists the units per side, and the first thing it lists are brigadiers. If you look in fighting, the first line for the paragraph on rules for fighting says each unit, brigadiers cannot fight touching an enemy unit, blah blah blah. Therefore, it's saying brigadiers are a unit, right?
Right.
And so it, I mean, it's not like it mentions it all over the place, but it doesn't refer to infantry as a unit all over the place. Clearly they are. Artillery, same thing. Cavalry, same thing. I think this is a case of, like, it shouldn't be that way, but technically, rules lawyery, as they're written, I think that's how it is. And like you, I think it's wrong, and I don't think that's how it should be done. Of course, I didn't write the rules, and neither did you, but, like, no. I think that's an unintentional mistake.
Well, you can look at it two ways. It's either it's just not specified, and so you could call it a mistake, or the general is intended to block line of sight, and that being the case, you can actually kind of play to that and move your general around specifically to block the line of sight to certain of your units.
Which plays into another question we had, actually. The command radius one, right? When do you test for unit cohesion?
Oh, yeah, I'd forgotten about that.
Or brigade cohesion, I should say, really.
Yeah, so as we mentioned before, all the units in a brigade have to be in contact with the brigadier in order to be able to give an order to move. And that can be through a chain of units. That's fine. But it doesn't say you have to start in contact. At least I don't think it does. So does that mean that you can then at some point, can you move the brigadier adjacent to a unit that's not in contact and then be allowed to move that unit? I don't think you can, because the normal course of things is you would have to be in command at the start of the turn in order to be given an order, but it doesn't say that. So,
yeah, this is one I only look quickly at the rules, so it could be in there. I couldn't see at my quick look, just like you couldn't see that it specifically said that. But again, I think it has to be at the start of the turn because it's one of those checklist things again, right?
Yeah.
Where like you have to see what the criteria is. And if nothing else, if you can check at for that at any point during your movement phase, it makes your things really being very sticky and unpleasant.
Well, it actually gives you a lot of flexibility that you probably shouldn't have.
Well, it does, but it doesn't, because you have to be very nitpicky about where your brigadier is placed. And the order that you're moving your bases of units, because that matters tremendously for like who are you doing first, because you can't like move through your own units, so you can't just swap them around or whatever. And generally where you move the brigadier doesn't matter. As long as he's touching a unit, you're okay. And like if an enemy unit moves into his square, you just kind of move him any, I think it says anywhere you want within two squares, because that's his movement. You can just kind of do that and it's okay. But if you're testing at any point, you can't really, those other things don't make sense. Yeah. And I think that's an illogical leap of faith or whatever that I think was not intended. So I really do think it has to be at the start. And like I said, it could be in the rules. I could have just missed it because I just kind of glanced at it. But I know you had taken a peek at it, and I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't see it. It doesn't say, but yeah, in contact at the start of the turn is what makes sense to me. So,
and then we also had a question, right, Adrian, about the path of retreat when a unit loses in combat and it gets pushed back, or it actually has to retreat to the board edge.
Yeah, because it says a couple of things in the rules. One thing it says is, one combat result is you get pushed back one square and the unit gets turned around, meaning it can't move the next turn. And that rule, I believe, says specifically that you retreat straight back. So that's fine. But then some of the other rules, how do I want to put it? Like if you have to go all the way back to the board edge, it doesn't specify a retreat path.
Do you want me to read what it says word for word?
You can if you want to, but it's clear that you have to retreat towards your board edge.
That is clear.
But does it have to be a path straight back? And the reason this can become an issue is one of the combat results is you get pushed back to the board edge, turn around, make a morale check. If you pass your morale check, then you sit there at the edge of the board. That's fine. But then if there's a guy that's in the same row of squares and he gets the same combat result, and say it's two cavalry units, now he comes back to the board edge. You can't have two cavalry units in the same square. So, does he have to retreat straight back in the row of hexes or squares that he's in? Or can he just kind of push off to one side of or the other of the unit that's already at the board edge?
Yeah, because if you're pushing everyone back one square and you have that, again, I'm thinking of the board like a spreadsheet, right? If you have everyone in that column, there's someone at the edge. Do they get pushed off? Do they get destroyed? Like, how does that work?
I think they would, because that's what the combat result, that's what the result would be if they were falling back into somebody. When you fall back into somebody, whoever that unit is gets pushed back. And if somebody gets pushed off the edge of the board, then they're destroyed.
And I think you're right too. But again, it's a case of, I think the rules not being clearly written. Because it literally says for combat results, if the difference is one, the losing player moves back one unit, one square, turning around the unit. This also pushes any unit directly behind away from the enemy. And then it says a little bit more about that. But then for if you have a two more difference, what you're talking about, it says if the difference is two, the loser moves back one fighting unit to the board edge closest to its brigadier. And there gets to roll a rally dice. And like, to me, that makes sense, right? Because your unit's going to try to go near the commander because he's going to be very inspiring and so forth and try to rally. But what if your brigadier is diagonal away, right? He's still connected away. So does that mean they're not retreating in a straight, direct path? Are they going at a diagonal? Because as we know, you have 360 line of sight. You can move any direction you want and it's all equidistant. So like, how does that go? Would you actually push anything back? Would you displace what's in that square at the back? And I don't know. I think
straight back. I think you go straight down the column, the row.
I think you're right. I think you do too. And I think you would destroy whatever. But as they're written, I can actually see an argument being made for no. If your brigadier is off your side, you end up saying an adjacent column.
Yeah.
Going towards that brigadier. And I don't know what the correct answer is, but I was confused. I'm still confused, even though I am agreeing with you just from how it's written. I think it's not clear. It's confusing.
It all happened so fast. I was confused. I didn't know what I was doing. You got to watch Klaus Kellerman on YouTube. Then you'll understand.
It came out of nowhere. It came at me from behind. So. Star Wars reference.
So anyway, travel.
Other questions or problems that we saw with this?
No, not really.
So what's your recommendation for people on this? What do you think?
It's good value for the money. It's plays fast. It's reasonably fun. It wouldn't be wrong to run out and buy it. Not for the price. It's £50. What is that? $65 US right now, maybe. Maybe a little less. I'm not sure.
Something like that.
So good value for the money. There are some holes in the rules, but it's stuff that's easily house ruled. They do have an active facts section, so you can go there and check it out and see how other people have resolved it. It's probably worth purchasing. I mean, if it's what you're looking for. If you're looking for a detailed study of Napoleonic combat and tactics, this isn't it. But it's a fun game, and it's not a bad way to kill a half hour, 45 minutes while you're waiting for something else to happen.
So you would say it's a game you enjoyed, you'd like to play again, you would look forward to?
Yeah, I would play it again. I mean, I don't think I'm never going to call you.
Would you go pick it up and buy it yourself?
I don't need to. You have it.
Well, that's true. But you might, and I don't want to give that information away, but...
I see what you're saying. I would consider buying it, because like I say, it's a good thing to have on hand. I hate to say when you're doing something else, but when you're doing something else. I'm probably never going to call you up and say, John, God, I'm dying to play Travel Battle. Let's get together and do that. But if we're going to go down to the store to just, you know, hang out, or if we're going to a con or whatever, I definitely want you to bring it along, because, like I said, it's fun to play. It's got the rules issues that we pointed out, but again, they're easy to fix. I would play it again. I like it.
Cool. I think that I'm less enthusiastic about it than I was when it first came, for the reasons that I've highlighted, mainly the unclear rules and portion. But what I really love about this, and this is why I'm giving it a strong endorsement, is it puts everything into one package. It's a full system. You don't need anything else. It's accessible. You can get playing very quickly. You can play many games of it very quickly. So therefore, you're going to become more familiar with it. And as long as you realize you need to have the right mindset for it, which is really don't be a jerk, which should be your mindset for any game you play, right? But as long as you have that mindset, the issues with the rules don't matter, because
exactly,
you'll form your own house rules, right? You'll be like, well, this is how it makes sense to me and us, and you work it out with your opponent, whether you got to roll a d6, whether you draw straws, or whatever crazy method you want.
Yeah, whoever hits hardest, whatever.
I can stab you faster. I mean, I know how to use a knife to open a box of maneuver. Like, so... Sorry, that's self-referential joke.
Yeah.
But yeah, any method, right? So I think it has a lot of that. I think it has a ton of replayability factor, this high quality of products, great price point. It's a company that you know, you love. Their products are amazing. And does this stand up? Is it as stellar as everything else? No. But does that mean it's a bad game? And the answer is also no. It's actually a really good game. I think it has a strong market. It knows what it is, so it has that great sense of identity. It's very clear to people what you're going to be getting into. And if you were to get it, and as a gift or whatever, and it wasn't for you, you're not going to be out of a lot of money. I think you'd be able to find someone else who'll play. And that's the thing. I think you can be able to easily find people to play a game with. Unlike, you know, other things, people might not be into your skill. They might not be into the rules or the period or whatever. This is just so accessible and easy. I've yet to find any set of miniature games or war games or any of that kind of stuff that's as easy as this. And I think it has a lot going for it. And I honestly think you'd be foolish not to try it. And whether that's playing at a game store, at a convention, or just buying it yourself. The one thing that I wish it had done for me, and it doesn't do, I wish it was one of those games where I felt compelled to always have it in my car. And Adrian, you and I know a guy, and I don't think we've seen him in a while, but he used to have his Trunk o' Doom, right, filled with must-play board games and all that kind of stuff, where like he could just open up and it was like the best of the best, like basically going to Board Game Geek's top whatever, and it was like all the most fascinating, amazing games, ones maybe you've never heard of, but were just perfect for whatever occasion. And I wish this was something that I would be like, it should be in the Trunk o' Doom. I don't feel that way. I think you need to have a purpose and you need to know what you're going for so that you then choose to bring it with you. But despite feeling that I don't think you need to have it on you all the time, like I think you should have a game like Zombie Dice all the time. I think I should have 1775 with me all the time, or Red Dragon Inn, for example. And I don't feel that way about this. I think this game still is pretty amazing. I think it's something that you should pick up. It's worth getting. I am personally very grateful to the Perrys sending it to us for review. Yeah. And one thing that people I hope know, but maybe listeners don't know, is that although we get stuff for review, we only promise that we will review it when we can. We don't promise to give great reviews. We don't promise to give good reviews. We don't promise to tell people anything about it. We don't promise or ask for specific versions of it that, you know, are going to be better or nicer than what anyone else will get. This is what you will get, right? The quality is what you'll get, everything what you'll get. And, you know, we're giving you the unvarnished truth for how we feel. And hopefully, like I said, everyone is aware of that. And Adrian, I know you didn't necessarily love the game, but you still feel pretty good about it. And
yeah,
I think it has its merits. I think it's definitely a good solid B-minus kind of game for me. And it's worth having in one's repertoire.
Yeah, I agree. I would disagree that I wouldn't take it with me all the time. It's the perfect game for that kind of stuff. But aside from that, yeah, no, I agree. I would I would say a B if we're going to grade it that way.
Yeah, I think there's a lot going for it. Just because you have to do a little bit more work with making sure you have the right type of opponent, aka one who's not a jerk. No one should be a jerk. And a little bit of the lack of clarity with some of the rules. That's just why I feel like I wouldn't have it on me all the time. But again, the only games that I would want to have on me all the time, I mean, they'd have to be quick and easy to play. They have to have certain things, but they also have to be like solid, like scoring 100 kind of games. Like if they're not hitting on all cylinders all the time, I don't want to have them on me all the time. And so there's a lot of games that fall into that category for me that are truly amazing and fantastic games. And, you know, this just happens to be one of those that's a great game, but doesn't sit in there. So that's what I got. Do you want to quickly go over your Things in the Basement experience?
Yeah. So at Huzzah, we were looking around to spend money, as I always am. And we found ourselves the Things from the Basement booth. And if you don't know Things from the Basement, he's got, pretty much everything. He's got a bunch of different terrain, similar to MDF, but it's not MDF. I forget what it is. It's made out of
each something or something.
Yeah, it's almost cardboard like. But anyway, we're looking at his terrain, and the reason I wanted to go to his booth was he also is a distributor for the Stasi's Heroes line of figures, and I wanted to pick up a couple of those guys. But we were looking at the terrain, and I was trying to decide. I kind of wanted to buy something to give it a try, and as we've discussed before, although I'm going to give it another try, my assembly skills are horrible. And I was talking specifically to him about foreground, in that, you know, most people could build a real house in the amount of time it takes me to assemble a building from foreground. And I said, so do you have any of your kits here that you could recommend for, you know, basically somebody like me? So he looked around and he actually came up with a couple of things that he actually gave to me for free, which is very cool. He gave me a kit for a couple of, actually, I think it's four crates, just shipping crates kind of things. But also, and I don't know if this was some kind of a message or not, he gave me two kits for outhouses. So I don't know if that means anything other than, here, I think this is what this idiot can possibly assemble.
I can't help myself.
No, it's okay. You're probably not wrong. But anyway, I did start assembling these kits, again, from Things from the Basement, and they're actually pretty nice. So this is the outhouse. I don't know how good it shows up on camera there that I started assembling. Like I say, I don't know if you can really tell looking at it. It's almost cardboard-like, but it does have the wood, the divisions between the planks on it. You can see he's got a little seat in there, which is both cool and, I don't know, possibly disgusting. comes with the front door, which has a little handle on both sides. You actually have to glue the handle on, and it's got the reinforcing brace on the inside of the door. So it's a, for what it is, it's a relatively detailed kit. And I have to say, it went together very, as you would expect. I mean, let's be honest with each other. It's just a box, and I can glue a box together. I've done it right here. But the pieces are keyed, so they fit together relatively easily. Just white glue holds it together, sets up pretty quick. So, but he gave it to me for free, which is very cool. He also gave me a little a white glue applicator so that I could hopefully, I guess, that would help me assemble better. I don't know. But decent quality stuff. These in particular, I'm not sure how much they are. They're cheap. They're like maybe $3, $4. I'm not sure. But just a neat little piece to throw down. I'll use them on a bolt action table, but obviously they'd be fine for, you know, your Wild West shoot 'em up game or whatever. Not sure how to paint it up yet. I kind of want to have that weathered wood look, so I got to get the appropriate like grays and stuff to paint it with. I don't want it to be brown. That wouldn't be quite right. But we'll see how it goes. Maybe I can show it off again when I get it finished. Maybe this weekend. We'll see.
Yeah. And you know, don't shoot yourself down. Yeah. It's a box, but it has those added features. Like when you said you had to glue the handle, I was like, oh no. And the bracings and stuff. The price point's pretty good. I mean, I'm looking at some of the stuff that he had given to me for review purposes, just like he gave those to you to review. So there's a Ghost Archipelago two columns thing. It's HDF, which is his version of MDF. And then he does have one of those outhouses you have actually is cardboard, I think. So there is a cardboard, but then the other stuff, it's wood. It's actual wood, laser engraved. So it's a more durable, higher quality kind of stuff. You get a lot of design and intricate work on it. When we were at Huzzah, he was really into Test of Honor. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see some Japanese inspired stuff coming out soon. And yeah, this thing was only $6.50 for the thing I have. Instructions online. If anything doesn't make any sense, he says contact him. He's really good about responding to things.
Yeah.
One of the things he says is that, you know, it's hard to write instructions for people, but like he can walk you through it. So if you have any difficulty in, you said you only use PVA to do it. You didn't use like super glue or anything?
Super glue absolutely will not work on this. I use just plain old Elmer's.
Okay.
Yeah, he's got a bunch of stuff. He's got stuff that would work for World War II, for, you know, Napoleonic period. He's got a bunch of like steampunky type stuff, which is really pretty cool. Got all kinds of like, he's got freight containers, carts. I think he has some furniture. I'm not sure about that.
He does dollhouse furniture too.
Yeah.
He does all these things. He had a very successful Kickstarter for Russian villages for 28 mil that you could use for bolt action.
Yeah. I'm actually considering buying that Russian village because you get, what do you get? You get a church and then I think four, maybe five houses. Price is really reasonable. And I may consider picking that up for bolt action.
You get a lot of it. And I agree with you with, the columns that I did, I only dry fit them because I wanted to see how it went. But they went really easy. It was very quick and simple to do. I didn't have any trouble. So if someone like me can do it, anyone can do it. I think there's a lot of value there. I'm not going to go. I don't want to go into any depth about the column here. And then I also did crates, like wooden pallets, really. But because I talked about those on a previous episode. But it's really good quality. And one thing that I think we should point out, because people often talk about this when you're dealing with any of this MDF, HDF kind of stuff, is a painting. And there's a fierce debate about whether you need to seal it first, or do you spray it, or do you hand paint or whatever. And we specifically asked him, right, Adrian? And he said he never seals it. Yep. And his stuff is gorgeous. He just uses, you know, model paint for it. And it doesn't soak it up, because people say like it's going to soak it up and everything. I know for a fact that the people at Gangs of Rome, that they had someone who did it, and he did everything with three colors of spray paint, just quick, you know, whatever, and that was that. And he didn't have to do any sealing or anything either, so it's really easy to do. And I love to know that your assembly was pretty simple, because I know some people do intricate things with, like, rare earth magnets, or they use rubber bands or all that kind of...
Yeah, you can... Yeah, a lot. You'll see a lot of people, like, if you... search for assembly videos of foreground or even Sarissa like YouTube, yeah, you'll see they've got like the clamps and the rubber bands. I'm like, you know what?
No, thank you.
I've been told, I haven't tried, I've been told that actually super glue will work okay on MDF. So when I get this stuff that I ordered from Foreground in, maybe I'll give that a try. And if that's true, then that will ease a lot of the pain of putting that stuff together. So we'll see.
Yeah, because you don't want it to have to sit as long as you would with PVA.
That's the thing. It's like, you know, you put two things together and it's okay, I'll let that sit for a day and then I can go on to the next step. Yeah, I don't have that kind of time. My life isn't going to last that long. I'm 52 years old now, so.
I was honestly surprised when you said that super glue wouldn't work on yours, because I really thought it would have worked on this.
Nope, sucked it right up. Didn't work at all. I didn't expect it to, but since you said that, I figured I'd give it a shot, but no, it doesn't work at all.
And for those of you who do have those longer setting things, I know a lot of times with buildings, people are concerned about getting that nice square corner. So a hack people like to do, and it pains me to hear this, but people get some Lego bricks and they glue them together. Mm. And so it forms that perfect, you make it a jig basically. And then you just put your stuff in and it holds it there and it gets a perfect shape. But it pains me because I love Lego and I feel like you're defacing Lego, but
maybe I don't think. Yeah, I don't think anybody else feels that way.
No, probably not. Again, it's just me thinking differently. So those are a big review for Travel Battle. We both give it 2 thumbs up, right?
Yeah.
And Things in the Basement, which we both love. And you have some more kits that you're going to be working on. I got a hay cart I got to do. I got, what else did he send me? Dry freight container, 40 feet. Not literally, but that's what it's representing. And a storage shelter. I didn't do these yet because they're bigger. And this storage shelter, actually, I believe it's for the roof. It actually has cardboard, corrugated cardboard, to give that nice roof feel. So I think that's probably what was used for one of your outhouse things.
Yeah, and,
do you have anything else you want to mention about either product?
No, I don't. Not really. If you're looking for terrain, though, you should hit up Things from the Basement, his website.
Yep, we'll have a link in the show notes. And Jorg and his wife, Petra, are just great people. I had a lot of fun playing Test of Honor with them at Huzzah and getting to know them. And just really delightful people who do an amazing job with what they have going on there.
Yeah.
Very receptive and amazing customer service. So I know we're going to specifically talk about more of their products later on to actually give product reviews. But just as a company, I love them. And you mentioned the Stassi's figures, and then they have their Southern Belles and Northern Beauties.
Yeah, I want to get some of those too. I can see myself putting out a whole regimen of those female scantily clad Zoa figures. Yeah,
I have some that he sent for review. And I know in this, we don't talk about politics on it because that's not where it belongs. But in the current cultural climate, I might not be the sort of thing that will be palatable to everyone, but they are beautifully sculpted. They're just really nice looking miniatures.
They are. And I don't worry about everyone. I worry about me. I think you can see that on the table and appreciate why it's there. You should be able to anyway.
I hope so. And I mean, it looks good. All this stuff is really amazing. And then they sell other things. They sell like Rubicon models and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So you can get a bunch of things. They're a really cool company. Where can people stay up to date with what you're doing?
They can't. We've talked about this before. I'm on Twitter. I never post. The Wargaming Recon Facebook page is probably the best place.
Well, I was about to say you're wrong, because people can stay up to date with all your pictures and things on either the fan club page, we'll have a link in the show notes, or also on the official Facebook page.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think you have access to the Twitter account, so you could post to our Twitter too, should you desire, which I know you don't.
I don't. Twitter's, I read on Twitter, but I don't post on Twitter. Twitter's kind of a cesspool, just my opinion.
And yet, Wargamers love it because they feel they have a lot of great discussions, but I don't honestly understand it, even though they expanded the character count. I'm still confused by Twitter. I feel like I'm an 80-year-old man who's like, what is the Twitter? I don't understand this tweeting nonsense. I should understand, but I don't. I get Facebook. I get Instagram. I get Pinterest. I understand Snapchat and like all, but Twitter just eludes me for whatever reason. Someone please explain it to me. As if I was a 2-year-old, but a 2-year-old would understand Twitter.
Yeah, I think it's funny that you say that, because the only reason I'm on Twitter is because you were like, oh, you got to get on Twitter. Yeah, Twitter sucks.
Well, because people, you get fast breaking news and you're supposed to have these amazing discussions. For me, Twitter's great so I can Again, yeah. Like an 80-year-old man, I can complain to companies and say I need better customer service.
Yeah, the average Twitter discussion, screw you. No, screw you. That's Twitter.
Well, so. I'm told there's better discussions among war gamers.
Well, there are, and I actually do follow a lot of wargaming companies, obviously. And it is a good place for breaking news. That's really kind of what I use it for. There's no point in following me there because I never post.
No, you don't. Cool. I want to thank all of our supporters over on the Wargaming Recon Army, which is our Patreon campaign. We'll have a link to that in case you want to support the show for as little as $1 per month. And you can check out our episode guide for all the new things that'll be coming out. We have an episode coming up soon with the people over at Dwarven Forge to talk about the Kickstarter 6. Stefan Percorni and Nate Taylor will be doing that. And then we get a variety of other irons in the fire, potential guests and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. You can see what's going on with that on our episode guide. We'll have a link in the show notes, of course. Well, I think that's all we have on our agenda, right?
I think so, yeah.
Well, thank you for being on the show, Adrian. It's a pleasure, as always.
Well, thanks for having me.
And I know listeners really enjoy having you on, so it's nice that we can have you on here, and hopefully you can come on some more often.
Yeah.
And I want to thank everyone for taking the time to listen to this episode of Wargaming Recon. Don't forget that you can check us out on social media. We have all that, you know, Facebook and the Twitter that I don't understand how to use. And you can email or leave comments on here or on Facebook and social media. We kind of get all of that. Leave us a review, all those good things. We're in all the places, all the things. And as always, no matter how busy you are, no matter what's going on in your life, you know that you need to make some time to play some Travel Battle and assemble some things from the basement. I really hope they started out in the basement. I don't know if they actually did, or if that's just like his attempt at the fact that most of us live in the basement for our wargaming.
I think it might be a reference to a lot of the stuff that he built initially. He built with just stuff he had laying around the house, i.e. things in the basement.
I hope that's what it is, because that would be pretty awesome.
So
no matter how busy you are with all those things, you know that you have to, you gotta, you need to keep on gaming. Are you always on the go? Why not take Wargaming Recon with you? If you use an app like Pocket Casts, you can listen to your favorite episodes of Wargaming Recon on your mobile device. Wargaming Recon is a proud member of the TSR Podcast Network. Visit wargamingrecon.com/TSRPN. For more information and to learn about the other good shows on the network. This recording is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. Many thanks to Andrew and Court for inspiring the show's name. Wargaming Recon is dedicated to the memory of longtime listener Andrew. I ask all listeners to join me in a moment of silence in memory of Andrew. Wargaming Recon is made possible by listeners like you. Become a Patreon backer to get behind-the-scenes content and new episodes before everyone else, starting at $1 per month. Visit wargamingrecon.com/Patreon to become a Patreon backer. Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by Enfilade. Enfilade is a flagship historical wargaming convention for the Northwest Historical Miniature Gaming Society. Enfilade is held annually over Memorial Day weekend at the Red Lion Inn in Olympia, Washington. Enjoy the largest historical miniature gaming convention west of the Mississippi at Enfilade. Visit www.nhmgscitadel.com for more information. Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by the Maine Historical Wargamers Association. They're the folks behind Huzzah! Historical Wargaming for New England. Huzzah will take place May 18th through the 20th, 2018, at the Doubletree in South Portland, Maine. Experience some of the best historical wargaming at Huzzah! Visit www.huzzahcon.com for more information.